His name is Nick Begich, Dr. Nick Begich, as a matter of fact, twice elected president of both the Alaska Federation of Teachers and the Anchorage Council of Education. He's been pursuing independent research in the sciences and politics for most of his adult life. Nick received his doctorate in traditional medicine from the Open International University for Complementary Medicines in 1994. He is the author of Earth Rising, The Revolution Toward 1,000 Years of Peace, co-author of Angels Don't Play This Harp, Advances in Tesla Technology, and Earth Rising 2, The Betrayal of Science, Society, and the Soul. He's also the editor of Earth Plus Flashpoints and has published articles in science, politics, and education. Nick is a well-known lecturer, has been featured on radio broadcasts such as Coast to Coast, and appeared on dozens of television documentaries and other programs throughout the world. He is our very special guest tonight on Coast to Coast. Nick, how are you? It's been a while.
I'm great. It's good to be back with you again, George.
Likewise.
It's lots going on these days.
Oh, my gosh. It doesn't stop, does it?
No, it's as much bad news as there is out there, I think there's just a balance on the good news side of equations. You know, everybody gets focused on sort of the negative things, but I think there's a lot of positives happening as well. And, you know, maybe we'll get into some of that tonight as we cover a whole variety of topics in this next 3 hours.
What would your father, the late Congressman Nick Begich, had said about all the events that seem to be unfolding nowadays?
Well, you know, I think there would have been, you know, a pretty strong strong reaction to all of this. I mean, even going back to Dad's disappearance back in the early 70s, you know, a lot was happening then. That was just before and just as Watergate broke, so it was a, you know, contentious time in our history as well. You know, and a lot of the very same issues that, you know, face us today, you know, face us, you know, almost 30 years ago now, and I think he would be as vigorously engaged as he was then, trying to create some balance out of some of the chaos that we see around the world.
And to a lot of brand new Coast to Coast listeners, Nick, when you say his disappearance, would you explain that for us?
Oh, yeah, of course. My dad was a United States congressman from Alaska who was on a plane flight from Anchorage to Juneau back in the early 70s. This was a campaign flight, and on board was Hale Boggs, who was the majority leader of the U.S. House at the time. He was also a Warren commissioner, a strong opponent, actually, of the FBI and their methods at the time, which are interesting enough being repeated again today. But they were flying from Anchorage to Juneau, and the plane disappeared at that time. It was the largest air and sea search in the history of the world. At that time, there were over 400 ships involved, ranging from Coast Guard cutters to fishing vessels, lots of Civil Air Patrol, and, of course, the best that the Air Force had to offer, SR-71s, etc. Nothing ever came of the search until years later when FBI files were released that indicated that the location of the plane had actually been identified, although those locations, to our knowledge, have never been properly checked out by the authorities.
Did you, at that time, or do you now, ever suspect foul play in this particular case?
You know, absolutely yes. Particularly, either let's say foul play or just gross incompetence. I mean, the majority leader of the House, one of the most powerful men on the planet, disappears with a congressman from Alaska, and you would think that certain things would happen in much different ways. We were privy to pretty much everything that was going on in the search, and yet these two telexes that originated from people working in surveillance technologies in California at the time, the sources were confirmed as being valid and accurate in terms of who they were and their integrity, yet those FBI telexes didn't surface till 20 years later. And part of the concern is that Boggs really wanted a complete restructuring of the FBI because they had at that time, they were tapping congressional phone lines. Any group in the United States that was opposed to the policies of the federal government were being tracked, searched, mail was being opened. Lots of abuses were happening both in the Central Intelligence and FBI, and so you've got a guy who really wasn't so favorable to what was happening there on a plane few weeks before Watergate, and, of course, in the aftermath of that, you find out a lot more. So nothing would have surprised me. In fact, my feeling about it is if it wasn't a conspiracy of incompetence, it certainly was an unfortunate set of circumstances, and maybe someone needs to be held accountable. You know, even today we can't find the names. They won't release the names of those that either reported this situation from that agency in California, nor the FBI personnel involved. So we really don't have a way to go back and even find out what was going on at that time.
Four people were on the plane, your father, Hale Boggs, as you mentioned, also your father's aide and a pilot.
Right, Russ Brown and Don Johns.
Were there ever any reports that anybody may have been spotted from the plane by other planes or anything like that?
Not so much that, but, you know, of course, there were lots of reports at the time. I mean, and everything was looked at. It was just one of those, you know, things that just didn't make, in the context of what was happening in Alaska, people need to understand this is a huge, vast region. I mean, flying over the area they were in, you can easily see how someone could disappear, and it does happen more frequently here than any other place in the country. So that's not so surprising. What was surprising is the reports back from government when we asked them about, you know, the SR-71 overflights after these reports came out, so we could look at the specific locations identified by those telexes. We were told that those SR-71 overflight photos were not available, that they'd been destroyed with all of the search records 10 years after the search, which I find, again, a huge statement of incompetence if that were the case. But more importantly, we know that there are no destroyed SR-71 overflights, that these records are retained indefinitely and essentially forever, because you're not just tracking, looking for lost planes. You use that data for a lot of different things, and those are very expensive overflights. And the SR-71 pilots and people involved in that program that have contacted us, you know, since this story, you know, really broke and we started talking about it, have assured us that those records have to be stored somewhere, and they would allow us to clearly look at the two potential sites, because it wasn't clear whether it was nautical or standard miles. So there's basically two locations that need to be looked at, and those photos would provide perhaps that missing piece that we've been waiting an awful long time to find.
Well, we are deeply sorry for that loss, Nick, because I'm sure that is something that just stays with you in some form or fashion for the rest of your life.
Well, you know, it does, but it also, you know, I think as you get older, you kind of look back on those kinds of events, and I think the worst of times are really what brings out the best in people. And as I look at, you know, what my family's done, and we're a very, very diverse family, yet it really acted as a really brought our family even tighter and closer together in many respects, and yet really pushed us forward into a lot of different areas that have been pretty exciting. I mean, Mark, my brother's mayor of Anchorage now. My brother Tom is active in political affairs and a lot of social change issues. My sisters are both educators. You know, we all kind of went into areas that were areas my father had been involved in. So in one sense, I think the work carries on, and you learn by everything, and we were young at the time, but big impacting event, and certainly one that does change the way you see the world.
Well, since we last talked, and I know you were with Art in December,
right?
On with him. What have you been working on?
Well, a few things. I'm just finishing up a huge project, a 5-year project with Chicoloon Native Village here in Alaska, and we've been developing a long-term sustainable development model for them, which is sort of another side of my life for another night. But that's been a really interesting project and an important one in terms of my general work. The other things that I've been working on, you know, since Jim Roderick, my co-author and research associate, has passed away, things slowed a fair amount in terms of that work. And so a lot of my emphasis the last couple of years in terms of just raw research and not so much of the writing. And we've prepared, I think, enough material now to publish in a couple of different areas, and two areas that, in fact, we're having discussions this weekend with some underwriters on the possibility of getting a comprehensive book on this whole issue of non-lethal weapons as they affect human physiology and human health, particularly as they affect human brain function. And I think that's probably the more exciting area. The other area of interest, and one we've been tracking for a number of years, is the whole climate change issue, which, of course, we've covered in the past on your program. And
sure,
at this point, we've got just a lot, an immense amount of data. Alaska is one of the places where climate change is being researched intensively, and the Arctic regions and the subarctic regions, the regions of this state, are those that are impacted first and quite dramatically. And in my lifetime, I've even seen that impact of climate change as this state has dramatically changed in terms of climate and composition of you know, just the whole vegetation footprints changing. Migration of certain species are changing. Water temperatures off the coast are significantly different, and it just goes on and on.
A couple of months ago, I had a guest, Nick, who swore up and down that the HAARP project, the entire system, had been sold to a British firm. Is that true? Is that possible?
British Aerospace owns the patents, but they don't own the project. They bought Arco Power Technologies, which was the original subsidiary of Atlantic Richfield, was sold first to E-Systems and then to Raytheon, which was one of the losing bidders on this project, incidentally. And then Raytheon sold to British Aerospace. And that's, but the actual program now is not run by the Navy and Air Force. It's now a DARPA program, which drops it down another level in terms of how you, you know, secure what you're developing in knowledge and technology. DARPA is more organized around straight military research for applications, for military applications.
A little more clandestine, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, when you look at the change, British Aerospace, that doesn't surprise me, because if you remember our work on the HAARP issue in Europe, when we took this issue by invitation to the European Parliament, the Foreign Affairs Chairman, Tom Spencer, was a British member of the European Parliament. Tom had worked with us for a number of years and allowed us several forums in Brussels to present our issues. And at the end of the day, the thing that he ran into going in to his military in Great Britain and researchers that he knew in Great Britain was, don't get involved in this project. Don't get involved in the opposition to this project, which for him was sort of the catalyst to getting involved. But there has always been a British link in terms of research on this, and certainly if you look at how real alliances demonstrated themselves in the last few years, it becomes pretty clear. Great Britain has been a partner of the U.S. in development of a number of systems, and you know, missile defense is certainly of interest to them as much as it is to us.
In your opinion, Nick, what do you think HAARP is being used for?
Well, I think, you know, the thing that the military says, obviously, you know, I believe, you know, what they say they are using it for, that the two other areas, what they don't get into so intensely, are more areas of greater concern. What they talk about is you know, surveillance applications for over-the-horizon radar. They're talking about using it potentially you know, for studies to determine ionospheric characteristics and being able to influence the ionosphere, manipulate it in different ways. All of that is confirmed in the military literature. The two areas that get very controversial, one showed up in a technical memorandum that wasn't supposed to be publicly released, but it was non-classified, actually talked about the use of this technology for weather modification or weather control, and that's that became a pretty big issue for the European Parliament and a big issue later for the Russian Duma, both which passed resolutions opposing HAARP specifically for this particular risk factor. The other part that comes up is the use of extremely low-frequency signals for what's called earth-penetrating tomography, and this is something that MSNBC actually reported on right after 9/11, back in late November of 2001, using HAARP for this particular purpose for looking at underground facilities in Afghanistan at the time. What people need to recognize is that the same signal range, which is approximately 1 to 40 hertz or pulses or vibrations per second in just plain language, but these pulse rates, if they transit certain what are called window frequencies, you can trigger biological effects within the human brain that are quite dramatic, that can end up resulting in an alteration of emotional state or a number of other effects. In fact, there's the most recent issue of a publication. In fact, this is the June 2004 issue of the Air Force Research Laboratory's Technology Horizons, and it's their publication kind of for the people that follow this stuff. And this is one of the new areas. It's called controlled personnel effects, one of the major areas of exploration by the Air Force. And this is what it says in this short little article. It says basically it targets military significance, including facilities, equipment, personnel, communication information system. It becomes, measured global. Here it is. Controlled personnel effects investigates technologies to make selected adversaries think and act according to our needs. That's the quote. And what it's essentially doing, this article discusses the use of electromagnetic fields for doing this on a small scale, something that can be directed to a selected adversary. But in the context of this article, it's talking about this general direction of energy-based weapon systems. HAARP is one of those systems, and the idea of targeting large populations to have that kind of effect is something that the literature reflects as not only being possible, but this particular type of energy, the way it's being formed, that is the effect if you strike these window frequencies that I'm referring to.
How many HAARP systems are there on the planet? Just the one in Alaska, or are they all over the place now?
Well, by different names, they're all over the place. HAARP is the official name of this particular facility, but you have in the ISACAT system in Europe, you also have a system that's been constructed across Canada. There are facilities in other locations. One of the more interesting things that I've gotten recently came from, it was actually one of your listeners on shortwave sent me a packet of materials from Australia recently. In fact, let me just grab them off my desk. This is on supposedly a radio telescope, but this is the interesting part. It's a square kilometer array. Now, that is a huge antenna, a square kilometer, 1 kilometer by 1 kilometer, a huge, huge, huge antenna. This is the size and magnitude that Bernard Eastland spoke about as being necessary for sort of the next possible step with HAARP. Now, I'm going to send this material down to a few people that I'm connected with to have them evaluate it and give me some feedback just to see if this, in fact, is the story to mask the story. And perhaps it's not a receiver as much as it is a signal generator, and that's really what I want to find out, because these facilities have been clearly identified in the northern hemispheres, but not so clearly, at least for me, in the southern hemispheres, and that starts to get pretty interesting.
Your website, of course, earthpulse.com. What are some of the things people will find when they go to that?
Well, there's a number of, if you look at the sidebar, there's a number of categories. I mean, you're starting to see things on HAARP. You'll see things on new weapons technologies. There's also a button called Empowerment, which is a lot about sort of the philosophy behind our work and what we're trying to accomplish in some ways that people can get involved on their own, you know, independent of us. But, you know, we've really acted more as a catalyst to get people involved in these issues and try and get these issues in front of those bodies and scientific minds that can bring good public debate. And I think it's been pretty effective. You know, the radio has been a huge venue for getting issues out, and the website just provides more of that data. In fact, one of the projects that we're going to be discussing this weekend is the idea of taking all of the records on all of these subjects. You know, we have almost 20,000 records in our archives, and we have about 4,000 of those records that have been indexed and abstracted. And we have a project that we're going to try and get all of that material uploaded on the web and all the public documents scanned and available so people really can get into these issues appropriately.
That would be a great research piece for a lot of people. Stay with us. Nick Begich, our guest. We're going to talk about Tesla when we come back. Also, the future. How about mind control? I'm George Norrie. A long time ago, in a far-off place, there was an electrical inventor. He lived during the late 1800s into the mid-1900s. He was a brilliant person. He had a lot of friends, a good number of them, as a matter of fact, one of which was Samuel Clemens, also known as Mark Twain. This individual we're talking about, of course, was Nikola Tesla. And Mr. Tesla has been really, I think, a steering point for your career, Nick, in some way, hasn't he?
Absolutely. In fact, you know, one of the first articles I read about Tesla was in a publication. You might remember it, George. It's the Coevolution Quarterly back in 78 had a couple of articles on Tesla that as a young person really caught my attention and stimulated my interest in a lot of areas of science that I really had not had the interest in before. You know, and that was one of the first things that I ran into when researching the HARP story was these references within the patents to earlier articles and professional papers of Nikola Tesla. And for those that may not know, you know, he was the inventor of AC current. He was a brilliant scientist. In fact, his patents actually fill a volume a couple of inches thick, and if you add in some of the foreign patents, and I have all of his German patents as well, and it adds about another half an inch or an inch to that stack. He was, you know, brilliant way before his time. You know, we're talking about a guy that did the best of his work in the late 1800s and early 1900s. The big competition then was DC current over AC current, and essentially the fight was between Tesla and Edison. And Tesla's a name nobody knows, yet he won the war, you know, I mean, in terms of developing the system that runs our industries and households today. So
there are some who believe, Nick, that he actually created and invented the idea of the radio before Marconi. But again, Marconi got all the credit for it.
Well, it's more than just a thought. It's actually a court decision on the matter, and it's there's a book called The Fantastic Inventions of Nikola Tesla that actually talks about that and has, I believe, a Xerox copy of the U.S. Supreme Court decision on the matter. The fact is he had demonstrated remote control, which is essentially radio, in Central Park in New York by operating some kind of a vehicle floating around in one of the ponds. And so this demonstration was much before Marconi's. In fact, many believe that what actually happened is Marconi read some of his work and moved faster and further to the patent office than Tesla did. And, you know, Tesla was more interested in the invention than he was, you know, the business side of things, which ultimately resulted in a lot of bad decisions and unfortunately limited what would have otherwise probably come forward in terms of his creative genius. As many people suppressed his technology because you couldn't hang a meter on it in many respects, some of the things that he was trying to do, including free distribution of radio communications and telecommunications and electricity, ultimately, was his goal, free energy.
And he came very close, but then something very tragic happened. Somebody did a few end runs with him. His funding dried up. He died penniless
right.
in 1943. But he got to a point, though, Nick, did he not, where he was testing the ability to pull in electricity and power from basically the atmosphere, tapping, I think, into the universe. Now, but who pulled the rug from under him?
Well, that was J.P. Morgan was his financial backer. And, you know, what people need to remember is the industrialists. This is a time of monopoly power and the social club of the wealthy in the United States. And what happened is...
That hasn't changed yet, by the
way. Well, not really. No, they just kind of do it a little differently now. It was a little more overt then. But, you know, Morgan was looking for... He had invested in one of the major projects of Tesla and wireless transmission. And what happened is when he realized that what Tesla intended to do was create the energy in a manner that really just stimulated what was naturally available, but made it tappable, or you could draw it basically by just sticking a rod in the ground, essentially, was the idea. And what was objected to was, how do you hang a meter on that? And that's where the funding sort of ended. In the, you know, Morgan wasn't interested in humanity. He was interested in the bottom line. And Tesla's view of the world was, science and technology was for humanity, and it was to improve the human condition rather than be used just for the selfish motives of a few.
You know, the guy was had an ability, Nick, to visualize his inventions, and then he made them.
Right. He actually did his testing in his head. I mean, he literally built them, designed them, could actually see them working from the reports that, you know, have been written about him. And then when he constructed them, they worked the very first time. You know, just if you think about just the complexity of being able to accomplish that, much less hold any image in your mind, but to hold something as complex as the design of electronic circuits and actually seeing them in their application. You know, one of the other things that hit me early on around the late 70s, early 80s, is I was in a welding supply house here in Alaska, and I ran into this really strange wooden boxed deal with a coil on the top, and it looked like strange. It did not look like a welding instrument. When I popped the lid open, there it was. It was made by Tesla in the 20s, and it was actually what's called a dithermia unit, which was using energy essentially for healing purposes, which was, you know, in the 20s was a big deal. I just didn't realize Tesla was involved in that side of things. And to find something like that in Alaska, of all places, these guys swore it was an old arc welder, but certainly it wasn't that.
Well, what a brain he was, and it's too bad that when he died, is it not true that the FBI or some government agency raided his home, his office, and took everything, his notes, the works?
Yeah, actually, I believe it was the FBI in cooperation with immigration, which made no sense because he was a United States citizen. A lot of the materials were carted off. Virtually all of the important materials were carted off. Some of it ended up in Belgrade, Yugoslavia, and then as for the rest, I really don't know who ended up with it, which agency, but FBI was certainly involved in the initial grabbing of it.
Nikola Tesla, what a genius he was, affected a lot of people, to be sure. And, well, you know what? Will we ever have another person like him, Nick?
Well, I think so. I think they show up from time to time when people need it. And, you know, I think there are those guys. You know, the thing about it is a lot of them get sort of captured early and put into programs that they end up working primarily on, you know, big government projects. People specialize a lot. Back in those days, the beginning of the science stimulated a lot different kind of thinking. So, you know, I think that happens again and again with new technologies and sort of the way people develop that creative process that ends up being some practical application. His genius is rare for sure, but it does appear on the planet from time to time.
You have been doing a lot of work into mind control. A little bit later on, next hour, we'll talk about some of your thoughts of the future with technology. But tell me about mind control and manipulation. What have you been working on here?
Well, this is a major issue. I mean, when you think about publications like The Economist, which in late May, May 22nd to the 27th of 2002, had actually a cover story called Mind Control. And what was it? The argument inside was essentially this debate about the ethics of its use, because what's now clear and is clear in the literature, in one of our earlier books, Earth Rising, we had dedicated a chapter to this with over 100 source documents, 36 U.S. patents, and a lot of military references to the evolution of the technology. And really, it's not a question of is it available. It is available in various forms. There's actually a directorate established for looking into all of these kinds of things for the military. The one is a directed energy directorate, which the chief scientist is Dr. William Baker. And this organization is funded by the Air Force, and their basic mission is to find ways to use electromagnetic energy to interfere or override body function. And so what they've done through the University of Utah, which in the mid-80s got a contract from the Air Force to build what was called at that time the Radio Frequency Dosimetry Handbook, which in simple language is the dosages or the amounts of radio frequency energy and the types of energy necessary to affect each of the major organs of the body, liver, lungs, kidneys, and brain. And what was discovered is that very narrow band of frequencies that you can modulate in a specific way, in a specific waveform, can cause the symptoms and the effects of liver, kidney failure, interruptions in breathing, stimulate a heart attack, or change emotional states within the personality makeup of the individual by overriding and causing chemical cascades within the brain that just change everything. In fact, early work in this area was done at Yale University by Jose Delgado, who by the mid-80s had perfected a method using radio frequency on humans and primates where, like flipping on and off a light switch, he was able to change the emotional state of individuals dramatically from highly aggressive to very passive and back and forth. And what he was using was an energy concentration that was approximately 1/50th of what the Earth naturally produces, which is considered just background radiation, very, very low levels of energy. The difference was it was coherent energy, rhythmic energy, energy that operated within these window frequencies that create these chemical cascades. When you look back sort of to the evolution of this, you can go back to work done at UCLA. In fact, there was a science advisor, Lyndon Johnson, J.F. Gordon MacDonald, who predicted this technology on a massive scale. In fact, he once said that if you could ever figure out how to electronically stroke the ionosphere in just the right way, you could manipulate the behavior of populations over large geographic areas. That was one of the triggering pieces that got us to really look at what the HARP system was doing, because that is exactly what it can do in certain modes of operation. That idea was echoed then later by Zbigniew Brzezinski while he was at Columbia University in a book called Between Two Ages. He later became National Security Advisor to Jimmy Carter, and he talked about the evolution of that very same technology. And the interesting point is, these discussions, these ideas were being kicked around in 1969, 1973.
30-some years ago.
Right. And when you look back, there was a congressional report. In fact, it was a significant congressional report on the Central Intelligence Agency that was released in 1976. And this particular, it was the, it was 1975, and it was the CIA Commission report. And I've actually got it in my hand. I'm pulling it off the shelf. And this dealt with mind control and the MKUltra project, which had been investigated by the Congress in the early 70s, coincidentally around the same time that my dad's plane and Hale Boggs disappeared. And his interest in the security agencies was a pretty high level, mainly the abuses of power, which are articulated quite clearly in this congressional report on the Central Intelligence Agency.
Now, you talk about manipulation, though, Nick. We have a device that I think they were going to use in Iraq. They have not yet. They said it has such a screeching sound to it of audio that it renders people down to their knees. They're helpless. Is this true?
Yeah, these kinds of using acoustic systems, you can certainly do that. A lot of these new systems actually don't require sound, and sound may, in fact, be the mask. In other words, the thing that they're hiding behind. Because the same kinds of effects can be much more dramatically affected using pulse microwave, for instance, which is a well-known method of disabling people from a distance. You can do it by generating either heat or other sensations, or creating nauseous feelings and so on, similar to flu-like symptoms. So there's lots of ways to accomplish that. In fact, you know, we had addressed back in 1998 the European Parliament, and at that time we had actually demonstrated what's called an infrasound device. That's referenced in the literature. This is a device that sends sound information through an alternate to the hearing mechanism. And actually, this technology, German engineers working with us in Europe have actually developed a device that's built on some of those principles that actually transfers sound directly through the skin. So I can put a set of transducers, for instance, anywhere above the shoulders. You can block your ears as tightly as you possibly can, and yet you'll get an audio signal, just like people are hearing our voice, right in the center of the cranium. And this device is used for speed learning applications and other things, but at the same time, you can create that same effect without a physical contact using a modulated microwave. In fact, we isolated a patent on exactly that, where you can take a microwave, modulate it in a specific way, and transfer voice information so that your brain becomes the radio receiver and it becomes that proverbial voice in the head. And it's pretty dramatic. In fact, even for commercial use, they're looking at this for vending machines, so that when you walk within a certain area in front of a vending machine, it'll send you the ad, but only you'll hear it. And that's coming. That was actually in Newsweek a couple of years back.
Sounds like crowd control, Nick. Control to keep the pulse on people.
Well, you know, when you think about what's really happening is, as the fear level rises, and, you know, they keep doing this, the interest in security rises, and with that comes immediate application of technologies. And that's one of the things that we have tracked from the beginning of our work, because what we see is the trend of technology, the really high science, is done in the dark, is done in the background. You never see it. And the difference between, you know, say 20 years ago and today is technology doubles every 9 to 10 months, from the invention of the wheel to where we are now. So things done in the darkness don't take 10 or 20 years to come out, where certain information leaks and you have at least some public discussion. Now it's 0 to 60, you know, in 3 months. You go from theory to product in many cases, or certainly applications. And so here you have a case of science moving faster than maybe the values of this population in the United States would dictate. And I think that's where we start to see intrusions in personal privacy, the interdiction of communications, and on and on and on as we kind of run from this this fear. And, you know, and I'm not I don't want to understate terrorism. You know, 5,000 people, domestic and international terrorism in the United States, have died probably in the last decade or two. But when you look at that last decade and compare it to other problems in the country, like medical malpractice, which in the same 10 years killed over a million people, I think what we're spending to solve a problem and what we're losing in the course of that solution maybe are greater than the things we're gaining. I mean, you know, 5,000 people's a lot. A million people's a lot more. And losing our personal liberties is even a greater concern. And technology was not designed to do that. It was designed to enhance who we are and what we're capable of as human beings.
Are they really going to be able to control the activity in somebody's brain, somebody's head?
Yeah, I think that's already there. I mean, if you look, again, if you look at the patent record, it shows the evolution of that technology. Already by the early 70s, the Central Intelligence Agency, by chemical means, had perfected some of that. But more importantly, under a Freedom of Information Act request that had been put in by a really interesting researcher, Harlan Girard, some time ago, started bearing fruit years later, and what came out was the accounting records. You know, the MK Ultra records were shredded, but they didn't get the accounting records. And when you look at the equipment and materials that they were purchasing for that program, it's obvious when you look at it today that they were using a lot more than chemicals. They were testing electromagnetic means even then.
Amazing. Stay with us, Nick Begich, our guest. My gosh, the hour's already gone. We've got another one with him, and then the third hour with Dr. Begich. We'll open up the phone lines, give you an opportunity to chat with him as well. We'll talk about what he sees in the future. And also, let's talk a little bit about privacy. It does affect all of us. What do they plan to do with these implanted microchips? Would you get one? I would not. Nick, I think you and I both agree that our privacy rights in the invasion of privacy just continues to dig and dig and chip away and take a little bit more all the time. Technology will make it even more of an invasion in our privacy, don't you think?
You know, it already is happening pretty rapidly. You know, just to kind of transition out of the mind control area into this, you know, one of the devices that was proposed by, and it showed up in a publication called Signal Intelligence. And it's the idea of using something like what you walk through the metal detector at the airport, except this one would detect general emotional state. So it would be another way to sort of screen out those people that are stressed that can be really looked at in terms of much more closely. So again, a privacy kind of question that starts to, you know, flip over to how far can you go? Is it fair to look inside a person and make those kinds of assumptions or conclusions? Is that an appropriate thing? And as this technology advances and we get more capable in this area, you know, where will those limits be? And that's what's not well defined. You know, if you go back before 9/11, anybody who talked about implantable technologies, you know, was, you know, that would not have flown anywhere, you know, and yet the only place that you saw it was on your pets. You know, the implant chips for finding them when they get lost and so on. When they get to the dog pound, mm-hmm. They can scan them. Well, when you look at that now, you see the dialogue. And we warned about this back in 2000 in Earth Rising. We talked about what was coming. And we said in an environment of fear, you'll see this happen. And that's exactly what we've got. So now you got these sort of open discussions about children because of kidnapping. You have elders who have diminished intellectual faculties based on you know, advanced age and the things that go with that. And again, you know, for your own safety. And then when you jump that a little further, you know, one of the requirements now for all cell phones in the United States is GPS, built-in GPS. And they say, again, for your own safety. So when you dial 911, if you pass out, they can find you. Well, you know, this is used for a lot of other reasons. That's why Osama bin Laden threw away his cell phone and all of his electronic hardware back in the very beginning of this. And there's been at least two articles in recent months, one from June 19th, and it was an AP story where they actually captured a terrorist in Pakistan, actually didn't capture him, blew him to bits, but they found him utilizing his cell phone signal. And the other was a program that really goes back to April 2002, and it was a project called Mont Blanc, which was actually a March 2004 story, again using cell phone transmissions for locating terrorists. So, I mean, you can see how they can be used, you know, in that sense, but at the same time recognizing that every time you make a cell phone call, they don't just track who you called and when you called and how many minutes you spoke, but where you were when you made the call. So that in criminal investigations in Switzerland now, and it has been the case for since at least 1999, they've been able to go back 6 months. Once they have a someone that's under investigation, they can roll back 6 months and track that individual's movement based upon cell phone usage. So, you know, those things are, you know, are becoming more and more available, and data storage times are getting longer and longer. You know, it's so cheap to store data now, there's no reason to get rid of it. So now you're getting even longer histories and profiles and increased transparency to the point where it will become to the point where virtually everywhere and everything you do will be traceable to you individually. I mean, when you walk down the street with your cell phone in 10 years, you're going to be able to see advertising directed at you based upon all of the history in public databases about you that's organized around your specific likes and dislikes. And you're going to see a lot of other tailored messages in that.
And you're not going to be able to deceive somebody when someone says, so are you at the grocery store and you're someplace else? They're going to probably know about that. They'll have a digital readout.
Yeah, like your phone number, like your name.
George is at the racetrack or, you know, whatever.
Right. Now think of employers. Now, would employers want that to know where their employees are during the day? Hey, you know, would they do it? You bet they would if they had that option available to them. They're already doing it on long freight hauls by tracking, again, with transponders where those vehicles are so they know. On rent-a-cars now, it's a big deal because there's a huge outcry when rent-a-car companies hooked in devices that could tell when you were speeding. And little to people's knowledge, but when they signed that agreement and put up their credit card, every time they exceeded the speed limit, got a debit. And by the time they got back to return their car, they didn't have any credit left. And the point is, these technologies, because they're available, doesn't necessarily mean we should use them. And I think this is, again, the question of at what line and who draws those lines. And no one's drawing any lines right now that are significant at all, except removing them, you know, so that more can be done about tracking individual transparency at the expense of what really ought to be happening is an increase in government transparency so we can make our government more accountable in a lot of different ways. Many of the problems we face have their root in government accountability, even the Middle East. I mean, why are we there? We're there for oil predominantly. We can talk about it any other way we want to, but that's what it's about. The $200 billion we spent in reconstruction and devastation in those two countries was probably sufficient to build enough alternative energy, windmills and solar panels, known technology, to not have to be in the Middle East for any reason for the next couple of decades. And that's the kind of thing that doesn't happen when technology gets misapplied. And now what do we see? This huge surge in government contracts for those things that penetrate our personal privacy and civil liberties, the very things that these wars and conflicts were supposed to be preserving. And that's what's being lost. So we may win a battle, but the real war is over the character and quality of our lives. And technology shouldn't be putting us into a tighter controlled society, but should be liberating us, and that is not what's happening.
Heck, Nick, the next time I do one of my secret society roundtable discussions where I bring in three guests, maybe you should be one of them.
Well, you know, I've done some research in that area, and I've had occasion to run into a few of the players on the other side of this equation, so it would be an interesting show. You know, I've met a lot of people around the world in this work, and I can tell you, behind every individual in high office or high position is a deep philosophical philosophy, and once you discover that, you know on which side of the fence they ride, and I think that's pervasive through our history, and if you look back historically, the same things have always been afoot. The difference is we've changed the names and given new words to make things politically palatable that in the past would be highly objectionable. You know, I mean, I'm in the middle of a campaign up here in Alaska, and one of the things that is always the issue is contributions. And what does a contribution get you today? Access, influence, things that average people don't have. We used to call that bribery. And, you know, this is a big shift, again, when you start looking at each of these things. We sort of smooth the words, like non-lethal weapons, as if they don't kill. They do a lot worse, and many do kill. When we talk about the Patriot Act, which really is should be the Removal of Privacy from the American Population Act. And, you know, it's just words that make things palatable.
Would you get a chip implanted in your hand, for example?
Not a chance.
No way. No. What if they come up to you and say, Nick Begich, you won't be able to bank, you won't be able to buy, you won't be able to eat unless you get this chip. It is a mandated law, my friend. Then what would you do?
No, I would not comply with that law. I'd do everything I could to fight that law. And you know, and that's the answer for a lot of this nonsense. I'll give you another example. One of the banks here in Anchorage was transitioning ownership, and the bank that was here was a national bank that required your thumbprint on a check. You know, that became highly objectionable to me. And what I did is call the bank when they were transferring and said, hey, I don't like this. I'm pulling my accounts when you transfer if you continue this process because I don't like the idea of people I'm writing checks to have to give up that personal information. And, you know, when that bank reopened under its new ownership, they removed that policy. It doesn't take a lot. It just takes some objection, and that's what people need to start doing. Voice those objections to your political leadership and ask for a change. You know, here in Alaska, we have one of the tightest, most important clauses of our state constitution dealing with privacy, one of the toughest in the country. And I believe that a lot of these issues can be dealt with on a state and local level where you actually have a fighting chance and begin to build that kind of knowledge that leads eventually to decent legislation that protects the public rather than makes us vulnerable to these technologies.
Well, and I've got to tell you, Nick, is it possible that this, let's say the implanting of chips in people, is it possible it would become a law?
You know, it is, because under the policies that are being evolved, I mean, the first step in this direction in the attempt was under some of the health legislation was to include this biometric identifier, and they tried it again under welfare legislation. And, you know, they're gradually getting to, you know, they're no longer using food stamps, going to purely electronic. And then the next thing is the fraud that they're trying to get rid of. So the next thing is the smart cards, which we've seen tested with over 3 million military and civilians around the world in the U.S. The next one is mid-2005. You get a microcircuit embedded in your passport. That's according to a Los Angeles Times article in March of this year. That will give you facial and biometric information. You know, DNA is another one, you know, that comes up when you talk about privacy. In Virginia, just a few months ago, there was a story that broke. In fact, it was an Associated Press story in May on Virginia, where they actually grabbed randomly 197 black men and took swabs out of their mouth and DNA samples, supposedly voluntarily. But I can tell you, a black man in the South doesn't feel too secure when he's rolled up on by a police officer in many cases. And so, again, you have these situations where because you can, they do. Now, that was challenged and resulted in them having to give people notice and let them know that they had a right to refuse. But all of this kind of stuff is becoming more and more commonplace in Great Britain and places in Europe where they don't have the same civil liberties as we do. They already do this. When they have a rapist in a small town, they'll have all the men come forward and volunteer their DNA samples. This is not the kind of world I think most of us want to see. And microcircuits and implantable technologies actually shows up in military literature from the U.S. Army War College going back to 1989 and 1990. In fact, the publications are cited on our website and in our work because this is the first time that we saw the military talking about the use of implants, not just for military personnel to locate them in a combat situation or measure their stress levels, heart rates, and those kinds of things, but they suggested this be embedded in business travelers because of the volatility of world affairs so we can find American citizens rapidly in the event of evacuation. Now, their story is they won't turn it on, of course, unless there's a problem. And if you believe that, I got a bridge across a river near my house for sale.
Let me tell you, there is a hotel in the St. Louis area that I will go to with some friends, and I'll drink my traditional iced tea every night while they drink their traditional glass of wine. But they had a computer problem over the 4th of July, And this will tell you what happens with technology. We've gotten too technologically advanced. You know how you have those keys where you put them in the hotel rooms now? They're cards. They're like credit cards.
Right.
They're not real keys anymore.
Right.
Nobody in this hotel could get into their room because the computer was down. They couldn't get in.
Well, think about this in terms of some of the technologies that are coming. One of the ones that gets talked about a lot is this idea of EMP, electromagnetic pulse or surges, and these can happen by a man directing something at an individual or a piece of hardware, but they can also happen naturally by solar surges and these kinds of things. When you get a more and more technologically dependent society, you also create a very vulnerable society. And this is something that's not missed on many of our adversaries. In fact, it's a major emphasis in when you read Chinese translations of Chinese military literature and the congressional reports that are non-classified on Chinese advancements. This is a major issue for them because they recognize that shutting down the United States, you may not have to do it with bullets and bombs. If you can come into the information infrastructure and collapse it, you've effectively done exactly the same thing that the biggest bombs can do. You've shut down the entire system. So you can take that from a hotel and ratchet it up and think about how easy it is for sophisticated individuals. I mean, kids are hacking through some of the most secure computers on the planet. Imagine in centralized systems like China, where you pull your highest and best intelligence and you put them on these projects, there is some huge potential problems coming down the line in terms of just our vulnerabilities. And these are issues certainly not missed by planners, but ultimately, plans can only go so far. The reality is we are a very vulnerable society, the very technologies we've created.
Twofold question. The first is, it'll make sense when you hear the second one, but do you believe in everything you read in the Bible or most of it?
A good bit of it, you betcha. In fact, the things that I have problems with are some of the translations, but, when I read the material, I consider myself a Christian, so certainly I accept what's there. And there are some interesting things there when you start to look at them through my screen, through my vision of how I see the world. I think that's the predictions for the future are there, but at the same time, prophecy is about warning. It's not about condemnation. And I think the lesson for all of us is we're at a time when this generation can make a difference and either accelerate some significant changes and forestall what otherwise may be inevitable.
What do you believe the sign of the beast might be, Nick?
I think when you talk about implantable technologies, you're getting into that whole realm. The fact that now we're seeing open discussion, and the smallest RF transmitter is a medical device, actually, that was written up in Technology Review. This one was about a millimeter square, so extremely small device used for medical applications. And when you think about that, this is something, these technologies now are so small, they charge on energy produced in the body, so you don't have to recharge anything. The idea of bank fraud and identity theft being the biggest crime in America and the least prosecuted crime in America eventually will cause the public to demand increased secured systems. This is what will lead to an implantable technology being accepted by the general population. We'll do it
absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, one of the things I think they'll first do is to make it a requirement that babies, newborn babies in hospitals, get one of these things. So they may not say, Nick Begich, you're going to get it, or George Norrie, we're going to get it, you're going to get it. But when babies are born, we're going to start with them. And I think that's one way they're going to get this done.
How about this, George? Is there small enough now to be injected with a vaccine?
And we don't even know about it, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, who knows where it goes. The technology through nanotechnologies, what we're going to see is increased miniaturization to the point where in the next few years that will be entirely technically possible. In fact, many believe it is already possible. The fact is that, this technology is as wild as it is, the fact that you see so much now in the open literature, 10 years ago when we began this work, a lot of these subjects you couldn't find anything except in the fringe material, and the stuff that you wouldn't want to publish. Now what we're seeing, and we're seeing increasingly so, is the boldness of these agencies to openly discuss their plans and directions. without any concern about public outcry whatsoever. And that is the big alarm bell for me, because that kind of boldness in approaching this really tells us a lot about what their data tells them is possible to accomplish right now.
Well, Nick, when we come back, let's time travel. I want to get your views of the future, and I want you to take us into really where you think technology will take us. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment with our special guest tonight, Dr. Nick Begich, right here on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with Dr. Nick Begich. Nick, as we look at some of the other issues involved here of privacy, of microchipping, and of course, I'm fascinated by the book of Revelation, because if you believe in prophecy, then you've got to believe in that. What's the motive for all of this? What do they want?
Well, you know, you got to kind of look behind all of this. It's really about it's about money, ultimately. I mean, when you really take a look at what's behind it, you've got multinational companies that don't really have companies are living entities in one sense. I mean, they don't have a soul, they don't have a heart, but they have an existence that continues in perpetuity. That's a pretty interesting sort of creation, you know, because without that, what really motivates corporate activity is the bottom line, the profit margin and the money that's made. When you look at a lot of the things driving this are really simply about that, about how to make the most money and shift wealth from average Americans' form of taxes over to corporate America. When you look at tax trends and tax collections over the last 40 years, Philadelphia Inquirer did a great series on this back in the mid-90s. And, you know, what you find out is, really, it's the biggest welfare program you ever heard of, you know, only it's not about the kind of welfare most people are fighting about. $440 billion, go to military expenditures alone. That is more than has ever been spent in the history of the United States, and that's supposed to be the peace dividend, more expenditures in this direction. And I think when you look sort of at what is that money being spent on, in the Air Force budget, for example, in the late 90s, 40% of all the equipment expenditures were for black projects, projects so classified even the Congress didn't know what they were writing the checks for. You know, this is exactly the lack of accountability that breeds the misuse of technology. You know, what makes government strong in the 21st century is their technology. And so when you look at the accountability mechanisms within government become extremely important as technology advances into the future. Otherwise, you end up with gross misuses, the kind of misuses predicted by Brzezinski when he suggested that as these technologies advanced in the 80s and 90s, that eventually what would happen is we'd end up with a more directed and controlled society, that no matter who was in power, liberal or conservative, would use technology to further political ends. That's the challenge that we face now in terms of how we use technology, how it serves human interests, and preserves those things that make being human possible. And that's our creative capacity. That's the things that go on within our hearts and souls, the things corporations don't have.
Let's look a little bit into the future if we can, Nick. What are your expectations, let's say, in the next 10 to 15 years?
Okay. During the break, I wrote down a couple of things. And the first thing that I really think is coming that's going to be interesting is this whole idea of language translation. You know, once the final innovations are made there, we're going to be able to, like, talk on the phone, talk to somebody in another language, and have instantaneous translation where it'll be done electronically. What that means is that when you think about the electronic internet as being the sort of global brain and storehouse of technology, imagine perfect and well-designed language translation instantly. And then you can take and multiply by several magnitudes the power of the internet in terms of the global brain. That's coming, and that's going to be fantastic and is going to present huge, huge possibilities. The next thing that I think is coming, again, is something that's been well predicted, is the miniaturization of technologies to the point where desktop computers, which are as powerful as, you know, the ones that used to fill buildings, those are going to be a million times more powerful probably within the next 15 to 20 years, or at the same time, perhaps a million times smaller and as powerful utilizing advances in nanotechnology and micro electrical mechanical devices.
Why is it, Nick, that that smallness of devices and inventions, maybe, you know, that's the way the direction of growth always is. You know, you look at, for example, you know, radios are so small now. VCRs are smaller than they used to be. DVD machines. Everything that's invented starts off big and then condenses and gets smaller and smaller and smaller. But why does it keep getting smaller? I mean, can't they just come up to a point where they say, I like it the way it is?
Well, you know, I guess, you know, the smaller you get, the more sophisticated your machines. And so in small packages, you pack a much bigger punch. And, you know, we're always, mankind's always trying to replicate nature. And when you think about, you know, the equivalent of a machine in nature would be a living organism, you know, something that, you know, has a function and some movement. And, you know, when you think about that challenge, you know, look at what the human being is composed of. And we keep discovering smaller and smaller components within our physical form that really drive this sort of outward expression. So when you see this race to miniaturization, it reduces energy consumption, utilizes resources more efficiently, gives you more for less in terms of money and power. You know, again, it's just this drive for creativity, I think, that drives so much of what human beings are about. You know, and when you look forward again in the future, you know, there's really no limits. And this is the thing that I've always believed, and I think goes back. You want to talk about sort of the biblical overlap, and it's, you know, the Tower of Babel. What was that about? Everybody spoke the same language. Hey, 21st century, we're going to reach that point again, if you think about it.
That's absolutely true. Do you remember the cartoon, The Jetsons?
Yeah, absolutely. Where they were racing around the little bitty...
little cars up in there, they're flying cars and everything. Are we at a point where we'll be doing stuff like that?
I don't think in the next, probably the next 10 or 15 years, but potentially here's what could happen. As you can see this trend in free energy research. In fact, you've got NASA now and the British announcing previously classified projects in the last 2 years. All those are early indicators that the technology is probably already here, and it's only a matter of time before civilian sector discovers it. So you look at that, that will change a lot of things globally if it's allowed to advance. And I think anyone who invents this kind of technology is going to have to make it freely available on a major scale in order to overcome the obstacles that would otherwise be in the way. And along that lines, when you think of research in anti-gravity technologies, that is now a known project of NASA and others in terms of alternate approaches to propulsion, you know, I don't think we're that far away. Maybe we're already there, and many people believe we are. You know, a lot of the stuff in the military, you find out, you know, 10, 15 years after the fact, the stuff was already available. So, you know, I think there's a lot to say about that and how that gets translated into transportation. I mean, immediately in the next 10 years to 15 years, hydrogen vehicles are going to be the big issue. Small-scale systems in Japan are already being installed in households for home heating using natural gas as the source, but there will be, and this is again, you know, they try to keep you dependent on something, right?
So, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and so, you know, if you look at the catalytic materials used for cracking hydrogen out of water, you know, that becomes a mineral-dependent technology, although that particular mineral can be recycled. If you look at gas as a source, well, that's still a fossil fuel problem. And that's going to be the challenge because industry, of course, like to keep you coming back for the refill when you might not need it. And this is, again, where the civilian sector, and, you know, and this is, again, a place where government, you know, instead of government spending $200 billion on a war, why not offer a $1 billion prize for the guy that invents free energy systems that can be verified?
Because they don't want it, Nick.
Yeah, right. You know, but
you're right. You're absolutely right. Something, you know, that's what probably got Dr. Eugene Maliv killed.
Yep.
To tell you the truth, I want to get your reaction to that too tonight. But they don't want it to us to have free energy. You know, I believe one of the major reasons, like you do, that we are in Iraq is to democratize this country in order to take advantage of their vast oil reserves. Most experts on the Middle East will tell you that we are there primarily to secure those oil fields. So I don't have any doubts about that. But what they also say is it's not that we're concerned about the use of oil for the next few years. We're concerned about the use of oil out there for the next 20 or 50 years, and that's one of the reasons why we need to start controlling these oil fields. Well, when I hear that, I keep saying to myself, you mean to tell me that they are still planning to use fossil fuels 20 to 50 years out?
Yep.
Nobody's talking about converting to a different form. They don't want it, Nick.
No, that's exactly right. In fact, you know where we're going to see that come is going to be in the countries that don't have an oil-based economy.
Precisely.
You know, and that's where the real opportunity is. And when you look at, you know, I live in an energy state. Oil is critical to this state's operation and function. And because I also know where technology is going, I know that it's a time when we need to start looking at ways to secure for that eventual future, because when these technologies start to advance, it's not going to be an overnight thing, because you got to build new equipment and new hardware, and you know everything has to change. But that will change the dynamic in terms of distribution of wealth and how money transfers around the world. And alternative energy, if you take energy out of the equation in terms of cost, and you get it closer to a zero cost, and I won't say close to the cost of water because it's more than gasoline now, but if you get it down there, then what do? You free up all that money in economies to be applied to, you know, medical care, for example, or be applied to solving some of the other problems that we have. And this is where governments should be a catalyst for that kind of innovation by offering international and national prizes for breaking these barriers of intellectual knowledge and to spur that kind of innovation. And, you know, using the old classical institutions is not necessarily the place where the best inventions come from. A lot of it happens in a closet. You know, I mean, you think about microcomputers today, it was a bunch of guys in a garage. When you think about the airplane today, it started with a couple of bicycle repairmen. You know, the fact is the best things that impact us the most can come from anyone, and it's a matter of creating stimulus that allows that creative flow to happen and people to be rewarded for it. And when invention comes about that has a very high human payoff, you know, I don't think we should allow a patent to be held on it. I think we should award a prize to those people sufficient for the invention. But if somebody comes through with a breakthrough on alternative energy that will change the face of the planet, I think we need to recognize them, pay them a substantial amount of money out of the public purse, but then make sure that technology is available to innovators around the world so real change and real positive impacts can affect us all. And there are ways to do that are fair, and we need to reassess so much government research. Who does it benefit? And this is, again, a case of huge billions and billions of dollars in research money turned over to academia that makes money on it by making partnerships with industry that avoids R&D costs themselves that we all pay for, and then they get the patent rights for 17 to 25 years and be able to dictate price. Now, I think we need to look at that a little differently when the public's money is involved in the research. The public benefit also ought to be there, and a reasonable payoff for industry to make it worth researching and discovering these things and rewarding the inventor, but doing it in a way that balances the ledger column a little more improved way in terms of human impact.
And talking about money, is it true that the oil pipe from the Alaska pipeline is not being kept here but is being sold to the Japanese, for example?
Yeah, that's right. And the way oil trades globally, if you buy a tanker of oil and you believe you're buying it out of the Middle East, a lot of times what they'll do is they'll transfer that oil to like the East Coast of the U.S. and then dispatch a ship from the West Coast with another cargo of oil produced somewhere else and then deliver that to the end buyer. That happens frequently. The other thing that people are unaware of is, you know, our pipeline is only running at half its capacity, and the problem isn't there isn't enough oil on the North Slope. There's not enough shipping capacity, nor is there enough shipping capacity for double-hauled freighters, you know, to haul that fuel, tankers rather, out of Alaska. In the construction phase now to replace those that are going to be obsoleted. And so what you've got is a case of the national oil problem is going to magnify significantly in terms of Alaskan oil development because the tanker issue is not being addressed by anyone, and it's really the bottleneck in the whole process. If you look at the pipeline itself, it used to carry 2 million barrels a day. It's carrying 1 million barrels a day, and it's sort of ratcheting down, put pressure on the state of Alaska to give up even more fields that discount prices and get the federal government to open up fields, which they are doing. They're opening the National Petroleum Reserve right now. They are opening potentially ANWR if the legislation passes in this next Congress, and there's a chance that it will. It's been very, very close. But these are issues being pushed when there's not the capacity to ship it in the first place, because it is not being addressed, because it's cheaper to bring it in from overseas, to cut deals with other governments with no environmental controls, no controls over tankers going from a foreign port to a U.S. port, only those tankers going U.S. to U.S. ports that we can regulate in the way that we regulate them. So lots of changes in the industry that have more to do with how to make the price of oil stay high than how to give people reasonable energy costs. And that's what it's about. In Alaska, the way royalties work is billions and billions are being made on the artificial hikes in prices predicated by global events right now. And the beneficiaries are, in fact, the oil industry. And, you know, you need to remember who's in office.
Who owns the pipeline?
The pipeline's owned by a consortium of producers, the producers on the North Slope. And so they built the pipeline. And this is interesting. You know, they want the U.S. government or the state of Alaska to underwrite the gas line from Alaska.
Right.
And, you know, the pipeline, when they built it, it was supposed to be $550 million back in the early 70s. And by the time they finished it in 77, it was $9 billion. So now they're talking about a gas line that's estimated at $20 billion. Is that going to be $200 billion at the end and be totally worthless in terms of...
Unbelievable.
You know, and this is, again, you know, the pipeline, they make money on the transportation. So they've paid for that pipeline, you know, in all of its maintenance and repairs and a profit margin. And we're in a fight with them in Alaska because they've been cheating the state and cheating the other producers in terms of the tariffs. And so there's, you know, these things happen. And when you look at it, if you looked at the oil is a big issue here because it's, you know, it's a majority of our state budget. And so everyone pays attention to those issues. And the thing that is easily seen is that domestic resources are being placed essentially in reserve while outside of the country resources are exploited cheaply. Eventually they come home when they get thrown out of other countries, which if you look at the history of the oil industry, that's eventually what happens when governments eventually recognize that the best way to produce oil in the public's interest is to produce it yourself at the maximum value, because after all, these are in fact public resources leased to an industry, not purchased by an industry.
Nick, is that pipeline earthquake proof?
It's pretty darn good, you know. I mean, it withstood that over seven pointer that we had. You know, it did not create much damage. You know, right now we've got some major fires burning right across the corridor. They're not creating damage. It was designed to withstand pretty substantial earthquake. You get into the eight points and above, maybe not, but below that, certainly.
You get an 8 point and above, we're all in trouble.
Well, we've had them here, 8.6 in the early 60s.
I remember that. That's a huge one. Stay with us. Phone lines will open up now. Nick Begich, our guest, so get ready. Nick, there is a new and emerging field called electromedicine. Tell me a little bit about that.
You bet. This is where the greatest breakthroughs are possible. You know, and this is, again, getting into the area where when you look at medical science, there's kind of a dividing line between those that sort of follow the chemical model and those that follow a more of an electromagnetic model. And then there's those that try and blend the two and call it electrochemical. The reality is that underlying all of these chemical reactions are electromagnetic field interactions that can stimulate and cause chemical changes within the body or significant changes in terms of how cells form and grow and mature and so forth. And so what's happened is electromedicine has started to take in its own. And what you're seeing is a big shift. You know, whether you look at some of the new things that are coming out here in the U.S. that have been around for a while, electroacupuncture is being used. This is using electromagnetic fields that are pulsed in a specific way to stimulate the acupuncture points much more effectively than needling, and yet without the discomfort of associated for most Westerners with the idea of needling. You know, that's a technology that's going to advance a great deal, I think, in coming years. In fact, there's now a what's called a cold laser method that actually uses a class 4 laser for treating disorder and disease. This has been used in Europe for now 10 years. It was challenged by medical authorities in Finland, and those challenges went all the way to their highest court. And the inventor of that technology, a very close friend of mine up until his death a few years ago, Rejo Mikayla, he actually won his case, trained 15 clinicians in this area, and had fantastic results. And I think we'll see more of that in the U.S. The other is along the lines of assistance for deaf and blind, and this is where some pretty exciting things are happening. I think in the case of the deaf, as an example, I'd mention this device, the SoundWave device that transfers sound information. Now think about that for applications for deaf populations, and it's a study that we're going to initiate later in the fall to actually look at which types of hearing impairments this device might be useful for. And we've had some, you know, preliminary reports from folks. One gentleman in particular, deaf in one ear for over 30 years, could perceive stereo and high fidelity sounds that he lost years and years ago. And, you know, these kinds of technologies, when you look at visual systems, what's being understood now, in fact, there's a doctoral thesis from the best, the highest technical university in Finland on the visual system that indicates it operates, again, an underlying mechanism is electromagnetic field interactions, and the way the brain interprets the information is not a chemical action, although that's observed. It's sort of the symptom of the cause, if you will. And so the idea of creating artificial sight is advancing extremely rapidly, you know, first just detecting light and darkness. Eventually what will happen, and we'll see this in the next 10 years, is systems develop that actually get you full visual imaging, eventually full color imaging, where you're able to plug into the optic nerve and transfer the information through an electronic device instead of the eye. That's coming. And these are, you know, these are essentially the jump is gaining that understanding of physics and its application to living systems, and that's where we're starting to see some real advances. And a lot of the leading research is actually coming out of the former Soviet Union because of their understanding of electromagnetic field interrelationships with human health, and both for destructive as well as constructive purposes. So pretty exciting stuff in electromedicine is on the way, and a lot of it is here now. In fact, we have some information on the web about some of this.
Very good. Let's start with the phones. Let's go to our wild card line. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Mr. Norrie, how are you? This is Jerry in Philadelphia.
Hey, Jerry, how have you been?
Pretty good. Long time no here. Coming at you on WPHT there, 1210 a.m.
Well, no, no, it's, you should be saying long time no talk, but you...
Long time
you,
no talk, long time
right.
Listen.
You got
I love your show. I listen to you guys all the time. Nick, I've been listening to you way back when you were with Art, and I always like listening to you. You have some pretty good predictions there. And I wanted to ask you, you were talking a lot about oil, and it's one of my pet subjects. And I'm sure you heard of the guy by the name of Daniel Yergin who wrote that book, The Prize.
Yeah.
And he's been writing some articles in various magazines lately. I'm saying that Nigeria is going to be the next big hotspot because they have both gold, diamonds, and oil all in one place. And if you look at what's happening in Nigeria now, there's a lot of civil unrest. I was wondering if you think that's coincidental or if that's part of a larger insidious sort of scheme there.
Well, there's a lot going on in Central Africa right now for oil, and it's not just Nigeria. Nigeria produces light crude, a very highly desirable quality of crude for ease of refinement and high gasoline yields. And when you look at, you know, Africa and sort of where the shift is, they're moving more into Central Africa because there has been, particularly offshore, some discoveries of what may be some large fields. So what you'll see sort of precede that, if the government isn't one that is easily influenced by American policy, you'll see changes in the government in the same way that you have in other parts of the world. I mean, why we're in the Middle East, go back to Iran with the installation of the Shah in the early 50s, and then what evolved from that was an unhappy population that didn't like the U.S.-installed government. Eventually, you got a more hostile government. We then sided up with Saddam to sort of balance power and provided him technical assistance and even assistance on chemical and biological weapons, if you look at the literature on that subject. And it was to balance what was going on in Iran at the time. And so, you know, if you look at all of the stuff we're involved in, it's really First, the interference with independent country sovereignty, and then secondly, the interference with their corporate structures, and then thirdly, if we don't like their governments, we make sure that government goes away and one more friendly to us shows up. That is not a good way to build the kind of relations that I think most Americans like to see us have. Central Africa is the next target, yet, you know, you remember a few years ago when over 500,000 people were slaughtered in Central Africa. We didn't even pay attention to that.
Not at all.
You know, and this is one of the biggest horrific things in recent history where nobody responded. You'll see responses now, but not for the right reasons, but for the very wrong reasons.
Out and out genocide, nothing was done about it.
Yeah, and, you know, you're talking about, you know, I mean, okay, so they don't have natural resources, but these are human beings. These are breeding people. These are people just like us. And, you know, what values does this country have if we can't express those fundamental values that hold sacred individual liberty and dignity and the things that build a future? And that's where the use of technology and innovation can really make a difference. And we're not seeing the difference that it truly can make because of the lack of a coherent political policy on technology and one that really serves human interests rather than corporate interests.
Why are you not interested in a political life?
Well, actually, I have filed here in Alaska. I'm a candidate for the state legislature in the community I live in. And
are you?
It is my first very, very serious jump into the process, and I think I have a very good chance of winning this election and maybe being able to have another platform to be able to address many of these issues, the issues particularly in Alaska that deal with personal privacy in the oil industry. These are critical issues not just for us, but nationally. There are a number of indigenous issues that are not being addressed in our state. Half the tribes in the United States live here. Those are issues that need to be addressed. There is great opportunity, and I think in a new kind of leadership and one that recognizes that public service is about that first. And I think that's a time for people who have a lot to say to start stepping into that arena, and I've taken that first step this year.
Well, you've got your campaign speech down to a science, Nick, huh?
Well, you know, I don't know about that. I've been talking on these subjects for a long time. You know, my brothers and I met last night to sort of lay out the efforts for the next few months, and, you know, we're very different politically. I mean, it's like night and day, but there are some basic things that we agree on, and integrity in the political process is what is missing. And whether we all agree or not, I think the real important issue in this year nationally and locally and everywhere, these elections are about integrity. These are about the quality of change. And I think that's really, again, this generation has incredible opportunities to create a much different world, and that starts with people taking some actions. And we've seen that time and time again. You know, the fact that our issue on HARP made it before the European Parliament was because of a listener to one of those early Art Bell shows that sent somebody a book that happened to be sitting in a committee in the European Parliament and later became the chairman of foreign affairs. So you never know what can happen. And the key thing is people need to step up to the plate and do something, even if it's a small something, to make a difference. And I think that's the hope that I have for, you know, all of these issues. You know, the idea that we can talk about them on radio and maybe something we say stimulate some spark in someone and they go off and do something really great, that's what it's all about, stimulating other folks to do something good in their own self-interest and the interest of their communities and families and future generations. I think that's our call as human beings to one another and our responsibility to one another.
Let's go to our first-time caller line. It's your turn. You're on with Nick Begich. Hi there.
Yes, hello. This is Dave, and I'm calling from Onalaska, Wisconsin. And I'm listening to AM 1410 WIZM. Mr. Norrie, Mr. Begich, I'm very honored to speak with both of you.
Thanks.
I've read your book, Mr. Begich. I spent 29 years up in Alaska and traveled to all parts of it. I worked on fuel barges, and I delivered a lot of fuel to the villages and a lot of defense fuel and so forth. Quick piece of information that I'd love to share with you. And then I had a question for Mr. Begich, and I can just get off the line and listen to the response.
All right. Are you still with us? Yeah. I want to make sure Nick's still with us. Nick, you there?
Uh-oh.
Oh, Nick? Well, Tommy, you're going to have to call Nick and get him back on for us. So you take care of it, and you tell me in my ear. So what was your response? I'm curious just to hear what that was, Dave.
The information I wanted to share with you.
Hang up and then dial.
Tom, make the phone call, would you? Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead, anybody. Huh. Well, let's go to our wild card line. I want to make sure people know that I'm still here on the air. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi.
Hello.
Hi, this is Victoria. Are you talking with me?
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, okay. I wanted to go back to a little bit to Tesla coils and ask your guest about them, if you can get them back.
He's listening to you right now.
All right. Congratulations. Yes, sir. I wanted to know, I was in the field, this was 1987, and I had a chance to be in the field, in the magnetic field of a large, noisy Tesla coil. And my question to you is, do you think that would cause a person to be... To see things.
Well, magnetic fields can be extremely powerful. In fact, when you look at electromagnetic fields, many researchers firmly believe that it's the magnetic field that has the stronger biological effect. Those effects can be varied, and when you're talking about a Tesla coil, depending on how it's operating and what it's actually discharging in terms of energy, it could affect any number of things within your body. But the question is, you know, what did it do? What could it do? Can electromagnetic fields stimulate, for instance, hallucinatory effects? The answer is absolutely yes. There was a guy, Persinger, out of Laurentian University, who's done research in this area, and you can stimulate all kinds of visual hallucinations, including the sensations of out-of-body experience, the sensations and experiences of abduction, a lot of things by just using magnetic fields, and that's his specialty, is magnetic fields.
And, can I ask you who this was? Because I have been waiting for an answer to this question since 1987.
Persinger, and his research is at Laurentian University, and if you look him up on the web, you'll probably find some of his research work. He was also aired with me on a CBC show called Undercurrents, which is Canadian Public Broadcasting, and you might be able to get that program from them, but they interviewed myself and Smirnov from the former Soviet Psycho-Correction Institute, Persinger, who did work for the Central Intelligence Agency and for Laurentian University, as well as others. So, you know, these things are in the literature. If you dig a little bit, you'll find them. If you look at our book, Earth Rising, The Revolution, there's a chapter in there that cites specific papers by these guys, so you can look them up. There's over 650 sources referenced in that book alone. Most of those are pretty easily obtainable source documents.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Okay, thank you. East of the Rockies, your turn. You're on with Nick Begich. Hi there.
How are you?
We are well, thanks.
Yeah, this is Lamar. I just had a comment and a quick question. A comment, are you familiar with the book Mind Control, World Control by Jim Keith, who talks about Jose Delgado and his experiments with bulls and different monkeys as far as simio-sievers, I guess is what they called them when they implanted these chips in their brains.
Right.
And also, what are the implications of someone having something like the HARP that can disrupt global communication but also maintain communication with those who are tied into it? I mean, is that something we should be concerned about? And what can we really do about that?
Sure. It's sort of taking both questions. The issue of mind control using implants, that was Jose Delgado's early work. By the mid-80s, he discovered that he could just use pulsed radio frequency energy and accomplish the same thing, so he didn't need implants. On the other side of the question, the issue of the HARP technology, the answer is yes, it can be used in that way to disrupt communications globally and yet carry their own, and that is one of the desired outcomes of this technology. What that means is, in a state of emergency, they could shut down all independent communications globally and limit communications strictly to military or official communique.
Have you ever heard of anybody dying from HARP, Nick?
No, not, you know, and there's a lot of the stuff that happens, and this is sort of a misnomer, is, you know, because we made obviously a clear issue over HARP nationally and internationally, there became some confusion over related technologies. And this is important to note, is a lot of people want to point to HARP every time something happens, and what people need to recognize is that there are dozens and dozens, perhaps hundreds, of projects advancing in many fields that can create unusual and dramatic and strange sort of effects. And so don't be so quick to jump to what's causing it as much to look at what else could be causing it, because a lot of these things, you know, directed energy weapons, for instance, one of the goals, and what they call all these is controlled effects. You're going to see CE, controlled effects, is sort of the watchword. But where you can do things like vaporize somebody standing anywhere on the planet utilizing satellite-based lasers. That's one of the things that they're hoping to be able to achieve.
Being able to target. Yeah.
You know, that down to that finite of a target, that's pretty incredible. But that's what people are looking at, is a way to move the battle space into space, literally, where you have absolute command and control. And a big part of that, of course, is communication.
All right. Stay with us, Nick. We'll be back. We'll have more phone calls with you in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Nick, do you ever foresee the day where they will be able to hook up a computer to your brain, download your memory, store it, and pop it into your clone body whenever they want to, and you'll literally live forever?
Well, you know, that's not so far out. You know, there's actually a document that was produced in the middle 80s, 84, 85, by Maxwell Air Force Base called Low Intensity Conflict in Modern Technology. And within that is actually a chapter that deals with electromagnetic fields. And one of the predictions is there, and then in literature that's referenced in the back of that chapter, is essentially this idea of being able to train people in this way, by being able to take sophisticated memory sets, develop them in a manner where you could literally download them into a brain. So you could learn, for instance, a language in a few hours, or some real technical application in a few hours, or vice versa, as you say, pull information out and then replicate it in another human being. That is not so far away. You know, the idea that a great deal of money has been spent on that in military projects, and you can trace them back to the mid-80s, and trace them all the way into the present time. So not so far away, and certainly an area, a desired area of research for military planners as far back as the 80s.
You know, even though Ted Williams' body's been cremated, they do have his head and his brain frozen for just that purpose, hoping one day they'll be able to download information from this brain and then put it into a possibly cloned body. It's an incredible story.
Who knows? You know, it depends on how you look at where's the information really stored. And I guess that's sort of the ultimate question, isn't it? Is it in the tissue, or is it in the part of the non-physical form that leaves when you die? You know, and this is going to be the real interesting thing that science may one day, you know, may one day substantiate the existence of the human soul and consciousness as separate from the physical form. And I think that's going to be an interesting day when that day arrives.
Well, and I was just going to say that, because it really isn't you, even though it might have memory, and even though it might have your physical attributes, it's not going to have the soul, because I don't think that comes along with the deal.
Yeah, and you know, you look at the body anyway, I mean, every cell in the body is replaced basically every 7 years, you know. And so when you think about it, you're not the same person you were 7 years ago, and yet you are. So, you know, you got to look at it in terms of what science is starting to show. And we're just, you know, we're in kindergarten in a lot of this. We think we're, you know, in graduate school, but the level of human knowledge is, I think it's kindergarten for a long time, because as we discover new applications and new technology areas, we also realize how limited our past ideas and theories really were. And I think that happens about every generation as scientists sort of move on and retire, and their dissertations are forgotten, and new ones are raised, and new theories and new concepts are better understood. And these are all, this is the challenge of being human, using that creative capacity in a way that creates answers and solutions.
Let's go to our wild card line. Welcome to Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi.
Yeah,
this
go ahead.
This is Darcy. I'm calling from Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
I'm your wrong number, if you remember that one.
I remember that.
I noticed that you said about the chips that are being put in that you thought they would be going into babies.
That's my guess. One day, yeah.
Well, I have a guess that what I think might even come sooner than that is, one, the homeless, that they'll, to get them to put them in, they will give them more food stamps and the conditions, and it uses to keep people from getting, losing their cards and it costing the government too much money to have to pay back that food stamp. Another idea is the people that are on probation and parole, that they won't be allowed to be released from probation or parole until they get one in. They're doing that now with
the ankle
DNA testing.
Yeah, and they use ankle bracelets in some cases. You know, these are cumbersome kind of electronic devices, but you're exactly right. The people that will be first targeted are those the most vulnerable, and the people with no civil liberties. You know, essentially you're a convicted felon, you've lost a lot of your civil rights along the way, and as a consequence, you know, you can get away with a lot more. And there are population, if they've lost their right to vote, for instance, as many do when they're convicted of felonies, that's one of the consequences. You know, you're really a disenfranchised population. When you look at welfare recipients or those that are dependent on governmental systems, they're not likely to raise much of a ruckus either. And this is, again, why, you know, this is where it starts, but it's not where it ends. It ends with every one of us. And this is why early in these discussions, people that have the capacity and ability need to voice their objections in appropriate ways. To force that debate and force that discussion, because you are absolutely right on. In fact, those were exact predictions of the evolution being put forward by planners and researchers, both from government side and civilian side of these issues.
If George Orwell could only see what he wrote now, huh?
He's rolling over, you know. I mean, it's like beyond anyone's expectations. You know, you look at the writings of Orwell or Huxley, and we are 50 years ahead of where anybody thought we would be, and quite frankly, we only know a small fraction of what's really there because most of this kind of research is not so readily available. You know, the things that we've done in building our archives over the years is draw on the unclassified documents, public reports, and put it together in a way that's comprehensible. But in order to do what? To stimulate discussion so that we can make at least the attempt to redirect the directions of some of these technologies by getting the public involved in these issues.
Let's go west of the Rockies. Your turn. You're on Coast to Coast with Nick Begich. Hi there.
Hello.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is John out of Los Angeles. Listen to you on Kogo.
I'll be back there in a few days, John.
Oh, okay. That's cool. I was just wondering if someone does happen to have one of these computer chips implanted in their brain or wherever, you know, in their shoe or whatever, how would you be able to check it, and how would you be able to make it not work anymore?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question, and, you know, certainly, you know, people ask that often. You know, the fact is, you know, shutting something off, you've got to know enough about its workings and how it transmits a signal in order to interfere with that signal. So that, you know, that would require some sophistication in order to determine, you know, and it would have to be active at the time to detect the signal. And these things tend to operate on very low energy, very low power. And generally, the way the technology works today is you've got to be fairly close to something that can read it, although that's debatable, just given what we, you know, what we know in remote sensing and what's possible. Many of these systems are not, it's not possible to guard against them, quite frankly. And that's one of the areas of concern that we have is, you know, the ability to influence behavior. For instance, in a Russian article called Orienteer that was translated into English and published under the name The Mind Has No Firewalls, actually breaks down sort of the different ways to carry a signal into the body that can influence behavior. And essentially, you can carry it on a radio signal, you can carry it on a TV broadcast, a computer interface. Virtually anything that carries energy can carry one of these carriers. So to guard against it, there is no single system. The best way to guard against this is good, developed public policy that limits use and makes it criminal to abuse this technology in a way that interferes with people's personal liberties and make government employees and researchers culpable criminally for abuse of the public or abuse of individuals, which is something that happens often in military research and something our government has actually admitted to under the Clinton administration. Energy Secretary O'Leary admitted 500,000 American victims of experimentation over a 40-year period, and not one single person has ever been held accountable for that. Not one single person has ever been held to trial on that.
Wow. All right. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. I appreciate you being part of the program, John. Let's go to our next wildcard line. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Hello?
Yeah, hi. Go ahead.
This is Joan in St. Louis.
Hi, Joan.
Recently, governors out in California signed a bill about a hydrogen highway, which strictly would be for hydrogen cars. So apparently he knows something that the rest of us don't.
Well, you know, Toyota has planned, I know, by the latter part of this decade to be converted primarily over with a large number of their models to hydrogen fuels. We're kind of leading the charge. U.S. automakers are a little bit behind the curve, but the expectation is that in the next 4 or 5 years you're going to see a huge upsurge in demand for these vehicles, and particularly if oil prices, which I believe they will be, stimulated to higher and higher levels over the next decade. So the opportunity to switch over is going to be there, and all of the trends and all of the big investment by at least foreign automakers looking for a way out from under oil, this is coming very, very quickly. And the competition is going to force U.S. manufacturers to engage in that as well. And they already are planning for it.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks for your call. Appreciate it. Let's go to our first-time caller line. It's your turn. You're on with Nick. Hi.
Hi, this is Stacy in Virginia Beach. Hi, Nick. Hi, George.
Hi,
Stacy.
I have, my mind is just filled with, I've been a big fan of Nick's for years, and I've recommended earthpulse.com to many people because the information there is so valuable, and I think you and Sheila are beautiful people, and I appreciate your work so much. It's so needed in today's society because we're just in such a crisis, and I'm very concerned about the planet and, you know, just everything, and this abuse of power and this technology, while on one hand it's very awesome, what the direction that my mind goes towards is solution and protection, how to protect ourselves from the invasive use of these beams. And, you know, for example, someone who's expressing a political opinion that's unpopular with those that are, you know, controlling this technology, how would that individual shield themselves, you know, from getting a microwave pulse through their home to kind of, you know, knock them out or something?
Well, this issue comes up often, and again, you know, this is where as soon as you start moving that direction, you're already losing the fight because you start succumbing to fear and personal protection, which is a normal reaction to when these technologies get identified. The thing about it is, the only real solution is evolution of good public policy that changes the way in which these technologies are used. And that's the critical element, because you can shut down one system, you can identify one method, but you really have to address this whole issue of, is it rational, is it reasonable to affect the human body in this way? And I'll tell you what happened in the European Parliament after our testimony. Back in 97, by 98, they passed a resolution that included issues on HAARP, but the most important issue was when we demonstrated the infrasound device, and this is what Section 27 of that resolution. The resolution is A4-0005/99, and it says, and I quote, calls for an international convention introducing a global ban on all developments and deployments of weapons which might enable any form of manipulation of human beings, unquote. That is the first political body to take that strong of a position and suggest that that happen. And the reason they did is we proved the technology exists. And I can tell you one thing coming from a political family, nobody ever would take on the issue of manipulation of human behavior as a political person unless they had absolute proof that that technology existed. And when we demonstrated that technology in an open hearing in the European Parliament, that pretty much cinched it. They gave us what was supposed to be 15 minutes to debate NATO on these technologies, and they stretched it to an hour and a half just for my testimony, along with the testimony then extended to the International Red Cross and other researchers in this area. So there are things happening, and my hope is that those same things happening in Europe can be brought home to the United States, one of the leaders in the development of these technologies.
I bet the globalists don't like you, Nick.
Well, you know, I think you're probably right. But, you know, there's other forces at work on the planet, too, you know, and I think that's what balances it out. You know, and often people have asked me, aren't you afraid? And the answer is absolutely not. You know, when you're doing what you believe in and you're doing what you believe is right and true, the fear dissipates pretty rapidly. Those I've seen succumb to fear on these kinds of fights or even lesser issues eventually become non-productive in terms of dealing with things. And if you really look at it, physiologically, if you look at an EEG on the brain experiencing fear, you're not going to make good decisions. You're not going to do the kinds of things that need to be done. The best is to get educated, and with that comes a certain calm, and then being able to do something is something all of us can do. And I'm not suggesting that people do what I've been doing the last 10 years, but within our spheres of influence as individuals, we can reach out and touch someone, whether it's these issues or other issues important to us. And that's the important thing. We all need to keep trying.
Let's go to one more quick question. Let's go to East of the Rockies. Welcome to Coast. Hi there.
Yes, hello?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah,
sir.
Okay. Dell calling from Chicago by way of Cleveland. They still cut you off here at 3 o'clock. Dr. Begich, you're not only a humanitarian, but a scientist, too, and I hope they don't use diebold voting machines where you're going to run for office. In 1960, they began to replace cycles per second with hertz, and that allowed a lot of misunderstanding about electromagnetic waves. Now, when you take chemtrails combining barium, titanium, and aluminum in a plasma soup, blast an EtherCAT or HARP signal through it, not only can you control minds and weather, but you can light that field over a city and fry everything within it. Why would then you sell such a weapon of mass destruction to any foreign government, even if it is English?
Well, or from England? It's really not about the weapon being sold. It's the underlying patents. And the technology itself, the contractor on the project, obviously becomes them, but under DARPA's control. And when you really look at these large aerospace companies, the interrelationships between them, they don't have anything to do with national boundaries, and this is one of the cautions and problems. Multinationals have a much different agenda. It's about markets, it's about consumers, it's about other things besides those things that those are just attributes of who we are. Who we are human beings, and you know when you start looking at how things are moved and manipulated, none of that surprises me. And if you really look at the connections between corporate America and what's happening in Europe, particularly Great Britain, none of this should be very surprising. They've cooperated with us on, for instance, the Echelon system since the end of World War II that essentially has allowed for surveillance of everyone in the United States and around the world in terms of telecommunications and other electronic communications.
Very good, Nick. The website again, earthpulse.com.
That's right. And we also have a toll-free for those that want to get in touch with us. And if I can give that, George.
Absolutely. A lot of people don't have computers.
Yep. It's 888-690-1277. And again, that's 888-690-1277. And we can send you a catalog of our books, and that's free.
Excellent. Thanks again, Nick. I appreciate you being on the program.
Always a pleasure. Look forward to doing it again, George. It's always a good show when we get to cover these issues in depth.
Sure is.